those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.
Welcome to Crime and Justice Radio, where we talk all things crime, justice, mayhem, and the courts with expert insiders and legal outcasts. My name is Aida Leisenring. I'm here with Bruce Barquette. How's it going?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm well. You're live from Albany?
I'm live from Albany. How about that? The magic of radio.
I would have a soft spot or look tenderly upon Albany, but you and our partner, Donna Aldea, pretty much lived there for 6 months during a murder trial.
Well, you lived with us, sort of, yeah. Right? I mean, you didn't live with us, but we were
residents of the Holiday Inn.
Holiday Inn, and then forget what the hotel was in...
Hobleskill.
Yeah. Whatever it was. Nobody cares about this. So, yeah, I'm up here in Albany. I have a trial, a continued bench trial tomorrow. Shout out to the judge. Judge, how you doing, if you're listening? Shout out, I guess, to the opposing counsel. I hope she's working hard, getting ready for tomorrow.
I hope she's listening in tonight. And
Yeah. Well, you know, actually, this is somewhat interesting. And this is leads into some other stuff we're going to talk about tonight. This is a wrongful conviction case. So you have individuals that were convicted. They spent decades in jail. In this case, this individual spent 25 years in jail. You participated and actually were critical to getting him out, not of the criminal case, but out of incarceration. So his criminal case was vacated based on a whole slew of facts that I won't waste people's time with. But the conviction was vacated with the consent of the district attorney and with the agreement of the trial court. So no doubt that the conviction should have been vacated. But immigration grabbed him. He was Dominican, and they kept him. And because of your work, you were able within, I don't know, a few months to get him released from immigration jail. And he's lived free ever since then. And I think that dates back to 2017, 2018, when he got out. And now, under New York's law, you can pursue a wrongful conviction claim. So if you've been incarcerated in state prison and your conviction's been vacated, and you can prove two things: that you're actually innocent by clear and convincing evidence, and that you did not contribute to your own conviction, you're entitled to compensation from New York for the time that you spent in state prison. This particular client spent close to 25 years in state prison for a crime that the prosecutor, the judge, us, everybody agrees he didn't commit. But for reasons that aren't entirely clear, the Attorney General's office is fighting bitterly over this case. Every shred of evidence is met with a series of challenges, some of which have some merit, most of which, frankly, are frivolous. It is simply unbelievable. This is I forget what day of the trial, probably the fifth or sixth day of the trial. It's a bench trial, so we do it piecemeal. But it should end tomorrow, and then we'll get a verdict from the judge sometime later on.
Can I make a few observations about the case that don't deal specifically with your trial, but just
of course,
because it was kind of a unique situation. So this individual spent 24 or 25 years, if I'm correct, is that right?
Yeah, close to 25 years
for a crime that he was exonerated of.
So yes, the prosecutor moved to dismiss the case.
Right. So the prosecutor agreed his conviction should have been vacated. Now, a lot of people go, well, does that mean the individual was innocent? Well, you know what? In the general sense, who knows? But I'll tell you this. It means he shouldn't have been convicted. And therefore, he shouldn't have wasted away in prison, lost contact with his wife, with his children, with his family, had possibly a mom die, father die, siblings die, lose total utter touch with society for 24 to 25 years. And this is what is extremely upsetting to me, even though I didn't live this experience. The day of his exoneration arrived, And he had been anticipating it. Anyone that's ever been exonerated doesn't just get pulled out of their prison cell and surprise, you're exonerated. You've been working on it for years. You have lawyers. They're keeping you apprised of what's going on. We're going to have a hearing. The DA agrees, disagrees. So he had been waiting for this day, and he knew and he understood that he was going to be released that day because the DA agreed, the court agreed, and his defense attorney made the application for him to get out after 25 years for doing time for a crime that he should not have been convicted of. And I believe that this date, this big date, imagine how exciting Christmas was if you're seven. Now imagine how exciting this day. That's like that day on you know, nuclear
steroids. Steroids.
Yeah. It's, so he was dressed in appropriate clothing for court and to be released in May. And I'll leave it at that. And what happens if you read the transcript from that day is the judge says, you know, something basically to the effect of, I'm very sorry that you suffered and, you know, I can't undo what happened to you, but you're going to be released and they have to do inventory, but you should be released in an hour or right away. So he understood that they would just basically do a body check or some paperwork. And the court said from this courtroom, he was waiting for it. And then all of a sudden he goes in the back and they go, too bad, so sad. Psych, just kidding. We're not releasing you. You now have an immigration hold and we're going to transport you to another prison. And that's what happened to this man. And so I cannot think of anything crueler, but what ultimately happened is NYU, we basically through the Bronx Defenders and their immigration practice.
And this was not a Bronx case. This was a case out of Rensselaer County up by Albany.
Right, but we pulled some strings. We know some people.
We did, and you did.
And we got them interested in this case, and they brought in the NYU Law School Immigration Clinic. So it was a combined effort with our law firm, but I give the students all the credit. And after 8 months, they were able to do what seemed otherwise impossible, prevent his deportation, but also get him released. And so I drove with this student to, I forget, it was a chaotic winter.
New Jersey.
Cold. Maybe there was ice, you know, it was cold. We drove to the...
A little artistic license. It was October, but go ahead. It was cold.
No, it was really cold, Bruce.
Okay, but it was still October.
Was it? Okay, well, I guess you're on trial, so you know. I just remember it being cold, and I had to drop him off. I had to pick him up in New Jersey and wait for him and drop him off in Times Square where he was going to take a train, and luckily his ex-wife was maybe, I forget, going to house him. And he walked out in a short-sleeve button-down shirt and shorts. And it was too cold for him to be wearing that. And he said, this is the outfit that I had brought with me that I wore to court and I was going to be released in May. And I'll never forget that for some reason.
It's unbelievable. And look, the Tish James, the attorney general in New York, who controls these wrongful conviction cases, I'm going to say a few things that would typically make you nervous. She's supposed to be a progressive. She's supposed to be about individual rights, fairness, justice, and so forth. She's not supposed to be just another essentially insurance adjuster fighting to keep every dollar that she possibly can simply because she may be able to. And that's exactly what they're doing in this case. It's exactly what they're doing. They're fighting tooth and nail over somebody who a prosecutor agreed should have his conviction vacated. And just to give you a little bit of the facts, our client is Hispanic and his skin tone is about the same as mine, right?
Mid-golf season,
we'll say. And the person who committed the crime was described by the only eyewitness as black, dark-skinned, black. without a Hispanic accent. There's other differences. There is no doubt he was not the person who committed this crime. Rather than resolving the case, i.e. settling it, agreeing to pay this guy who spent 25 years in prison for a crime he clearly didn't commit and for a crime that a prosecutor and a judge agreed should be vacated, or a conviction that should be vacated, they are fighting tooth and nail over every shred of evidence as if it was their money. And I'm not saying they should just give the money away, but part of being a progressive and part of being a progressive prosecutor should be some sense of fairness and justice. And looking at somebody who spent 25 years in prison saying, you know what, I don't know if we can win or lose this on the technicalities. Can we prove by clear and convincing evidence that he did not do it? Like, there's no DNA here. There is no, you know, hard and fast evidence. It's simply an analysis of the facts. Our client is rough around the edges, to say the least. He was involved in bad things back in those days, but he just didn't commit this crime. You would think a progressive attorney general would look to resolve these cases. To the contrary. And it does not speak well, frankly, of the current attorney general in New York. It really doesn't. So that's I wasn't going to go there, but what the heck?
Well, you said something. I'm actually
going to. It really does bother me. And the manner in which this case has been litigated has been troubling on a host of levels that I won't go into. And look, the burden here is tough. It's by clear and convincing evidence. And you would think that if somebody got out, they fought bitterly, they got out, the prosecutor insists that he did it, the judge isn't sure, but somehow they cleared the hurdle to have their conviction vacated, which is rare. Rare as a hen's tooth. These doesn't happen all the time. Most of the people, almost everybody stays in jail. When it happens, when a judge and the prosecutor agree that the conviction was unjust and should be vacated, those cases, those should be the easy ones. Those should be the easy ones. And unfortunately, in part for different reasons, this has not been an easy one. And we'll continue to litigate this until we get justice for this guy. And well, people talk about them.
I wish you luck and, you know, for the right thing to happen here for him.
Yeah, no, for sure. And the Wrongful Conviction Act is different in every state for people that have been convicted of crimes that they didn't commit and served decades in prison. So, Aida, I won't give away your age, but roll back 25 years. And I want to ask you, what's the amount of money that you would accept to trade those 25 years for the life that you lived and instead be incarcerated in a state prison? Because
for me, zero.
Right. No, not zero. There's no amount of money in the world, right? You couldn't put a dollar figure with enough zeros at the end of it for me to waste.
I meant zero. The world out here is scary. I'm teasing. Yeah. There's absolutely.
So there's no amount of and typically what the cases settle for an amount of money and the individual, it's life changing for these people because they have no money, no hope, no education, or very little education, and they've been incarcerated for 25 years. Who's going to hire them?
It's so
our guy, we've had to pay for him to take a bus back and forth from Rensselaer, where he lives, to Albany, to where the courthouse is. We've had to buy him a suit, get him a tie, and he's still rough around the edges. He's polite, he's courteous, he has manners, but they're not the manners that, you know, we would find in polite society, if you will.
That's actually an interesting point, and that I learned as a legal aid practitioner. I mean, I knew this before. It's probably part of the reason I wanted to be a public defender. But a lot of people look at individuals who are uneducated. And if you're uneducated, you may not be able to communicate and express yourself in the same manner as you would expect of someone who's a professional, so to speak. And can be described as rough around the edges. Sometimes they aren't able to articulate their innocence or articulate it convincingly because they're upset, they're beat down, they're understanding, and, you know, maybe perceived as aggressive. But that, if you're the kind of person that can see through that or sophisticated, I dare say sophisticated enough to be able to see through that, and understand this is about, you know, not just the individual, but the evidence surrounding the case and, you know, the lawfulness of the conduct and so forth. You realize that a lot of people are just literally thrown in prison because of the way they act, not necessarily because of the crimes they committed.
Well, he, look, in fairness, he was involved in a, he was a drug addict at the time, was involved in a whole range of troubling activity. And you know what the old saying is, right? That you be careful who your friends are. Don't stay out of bad neighborhoods because bad things happen in bad neighborhoods. And a really horrific thing happened to him, which is he ended up being incarcerated for all this time. And it's not clear as we sit here whether or not he'll get the level of justice that he certainly is entitled to. But let's talk a little bit about.
Well, I want
to. Go ahead.
We have, I think, like 3 minutes left before we go into break. And I don't know if what were you planning to talk about? Because it might be a 21-minute conversation.
Well, we can talk. We have more than 3 minutes. We have a break in a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about the first thing I said on the first day that we did this show. You remember?
What are we doing here?
What are we doing here? Don't we have clients to represent, briefs to write, witnesses to prepare, cross-examinations to get ready for, trials to conduct? And the answer to that question is and was at the time, well, some not, because we started in April of 2021 when COVID was in full bloom. We've had a number of great guests. We've put on over 100 shows, believe it or not. This is, I think, our 101st or 102nd. And it's been a good run. It's been a really good run. But it's going to come to an end because all the trials that we're doing, you and I spent 5 or 6 weeks in March and April out of town on trial, couldn't do the show. I'm up here in Albany. In another couple of weeks, we're going to be out of town again doing another trial. We wouldn't be able to do the show. September's going to come. There's going to be more trials. And
I'm exhausted just thinking about it.
our day job is going to overtake us. So
yeah.
Do you want to say it or should I?
But this is our last show for some time.
This is our final show on LI News Radio, which has been a great place for us, a great host. We love being here. They gave us an opportunity to do these shows. We've talked to a number of great people over the years. If you want to, and I'd encourage people to go to our website, BarquetteEpstein.com, and go back and you can listen to some of the other episodes with people like Bill Cosby's lawyer, Harvey Weinstein's lawyer.
Amanda Knox,
Aaron Moriarty from 48 Hours.
Barry Scheck
from the Innocence Project. Two prosecutors in Long Island. We had multiple interviews with both Ray Tierney and Ann Donnelly. We had Ray Tierney on when he had just announced that he was going to run, when nobody thought he was going to win. Nobody thought he was going to win. It was almost kind of a throwaway race in the minds of many. He's now this district attorney in Suffolk County. Look at him now. So we've had judges, a couple of different judges. We had an individual who ran executions in Florida and Texas to talk about his experience and how those experiences of participating in the killing of another human being changed him and brought him around to becoming an abolitionist. He's now against the death penalty. We've had on the lawyer who represented the Mauritanian. Did I say that right?
The Mauritanian. Nancy Hollander represented an individual who was innocent and was coerced, beaten, sexually violated, tortured to give a false confession. Ultimately, he was exonerated with the blessing and participation of the U.S. attorney in that case. And Nancy Hollander, who appeared on our show, was played by Jodie Foster in an amazing movie that I recommend to everyone, The Mauritanian.
So these shows can still be heard on our website at BarquetteEpstein.com. Feel free to go there and check them out, listen to them, listen to parts of them, listen to whatever the interviews are. We had Ron Kuby on very entertaining lawyer and a very entertaining show. We laughed a lot during that. It is really a spectacular set of shows that I'm very proud of and very honored to have been a part of. Been great working with you. We're going to come back in just a few minutes to continue with this show, talk about a Supreme Court case that we think is critically important. And we'll talk about that. You're telling me no, we're not going to do that, but we'll see. We'll see what we chat about when we come back. Come back afterwards and check out our website, BarquetteEpstein.com, not only for the shows, but for the work that we do, our day job. We'll be back after a few seconds or a few minutes of commercials and traffic and weather and news and so forth.
Crime and Justice Radio. My name is Aida Leisenring, and I am back with Bruce Barquette. Bruce, you with us?
I am back. I am back. I was just looking at a protest over the potential ban of wood-burning stoves in New York City, and it is so funny. What happened was somebody brought a bunch of pizzas to City Hall and started throwing the pizza at the City Hall over the fence, yelling, "Give us pizza or give us death." I love pizza.
So that's your excuse for coming on late to the show. That's a pretty good excuse.
It is. I mean, it's just more nonsense from crazy people who want to ban gas burning stoves, wood burning stoves, this, that, the other thing.
And give pizza. Me a break. New York City pizza.
New York City pizza. Yeah, exactly. Give me pizza or give me death. It's too funny.
Well, today, Oliver caught me off guard, or rather confused me, but it's totally understandable when he asked me a question about my views on the Scott Peterson case. And I immediately thought to myself, wait, I thought his death penalty conviction was commuted and he got life in prison. Of course, I was thinking of Scott Peterson, S-C-O-T-T of California, who is charged and convicted of killing his wife while having an affair with another woman. And he's famous. There's Netflix documentaries out about him. He was all the rage, all the news. But no, there is apparently another Scott Peterson, and his name is spelled with one T. Not two, not that I would have noted that distinction. And it's actually a fascinating case. Scott Peterson was a school security officer present and working and reporting to duty when the Parkland shooter, I think it was Nicholas, I'm forgetting his last name, shot and murdered and maimed students and teachers The shooter has done trial.
You're talking about the Parkland shooting where there was a like 17 individuals were murdered in the high school. And one of the controversial parts of that, I mean, there's nothing easy about it, is there was a school security guard who did not act or did not act quickly enough. And he ended up apparently or allegedly telling police something that may not have been true about the gunshots he heard and so forth. He was roundly criticized at the time. He was displayed on TV. The videotape of him just kind of standing there while the shots were going off is still available, I guess.
So, and not to be confused, of course, with the Uvalde police officers who waited about an hour before even allowing people to go in and help and provide assistance to the students. In any case, he was charged and he's been tried on charges involving child neglect under Florida statute, which applies to caretakers. Prosecutors are arguing that in his capacity as a school resource officer, Scott Peterson was responsible for protecting the high school students and staff that he should have run in. They're not arguing he should have killed the shooter and been sending himself on a suicide mission, but that he should have slowed him down, distracted him, and done anything possible so that the kids could have been safe. And yes, he is charged with, I believe, one count of perjury because he indicated that he only heard three gunshots. And I think it was apparent that 70 gunshots went off. So closing arguments have been completed. He has been tried and we await a jury verdict, I guess, tomorrow or in the next few days. And it's sort of wild because he showed up about 2 minutes after the shooting began, and the shooting ended about 4 minutes later. So what he's charged with is that 4 minutes that he didn't react the way prosecutors believe he should have reacted. And what the defense is saying is that it's easy to say that, but it's another thing to be in his shoes and experience what he experienced at that very moment. There was confusion. There were shots fired that were echoing everywhere. And they claim that he didn't know, he didn't have knowledge that the shooting was specifically occurring on the third floor. Now, he's been charged with 7 counts, not the 17 counts of the other individuals that died, because they're only charging him for failure to act on the third floor of that specific area where I believe 7 individuals either died and or were injured.
So I'd be curious to what our audience has to say about this. If anybody wants to chime in a little bit, our number is 631-451-1039. It's 631-451-1039. I'm curious to what people think about this prosecution, not what you think about his conduct. And, you know, all the brave souls out there with, you know, beer muscles saying I would have done this or I would have done that. None of us know what we would have done.
But should resource officer, essentially a security guard, in this case, he's a 60-year-old man that had been trained in the past for, you know, heightened violent situations. If he does not react according to his training and individuals get injured or killed, should that individual be charged for his failure to act criminally on child neglect charges? The assertions are that, I guess, run consecutively, these counts could ultimately result in a lifetime incarceration. I doubt that would be the case for him.
Well, you doubt that would be the case, but who would have thought he would be prosecuted for, you know, freezing for a couple of minutes? And, you know, when Jay asked us about it this morning, and I said, cowardice is not a crime. Even if that's what happened here, he just panicked and froze. That's not criminal. We can't prosecute people for that, or at least I don't think we should. Like I said, I'm curious if any listeners have a view. 631-451-1039. You can call and talk about that or congratulate us on our 102 shows and say goodbye. But it really is an unbelievable set of circumstance. And you contrast that with 4 minutes compared to a number of armed, trained, bulletproof, vested officers who sat outside of that school in Texas for an inordinate amount of time with the mothers. One mother ran in to get her daughter, got her two kids out, and had to fight through them. And she was charged later with breaking a police barrier or crossing a police barrier. True fact. I don't know what happened.
She was charged. She might have even pled guilty.
Unbelievable. And this guy, now look, if you're taking on this position, you have to understand that it comes with responsibilities. It's kind of akin to a lifeguard not diving into the water to save somebody, sort of. You're there for a purpose.
You bring an interesting point. If he can be brought to trial for failure to act as a security guard when there is an active shooter, there's mayhem, there's confusion, and your acting may result in your own death, which, yes, you're essentially there to be braver than ever. You're being paid to be braver than anyone else. But if he can be brought to trial, then presumably lifeguards that don't jump into a riptide to save a child can also be criminally charged. And what the lawyers here said was that the statute, which typically in almost every state relates to parents, right? Parents who endanger the welfare of their children.
Or babysitters. Right.
Right. And a duty of care in that regard in a way that, you know, is unquestionable. The defense lawyer said this statute does not apply. It applies to caretakers. It doesn't apply to school resource officers. They're not responsible for 100 students. And the judge ruled that that determination, which to me is a question of law, not a question of fact, would be made by the jury. You and I have seen those kind of rulings before. They're rare, where something that's purely an issue of law gets the buck gets passed to the jury. But I would be interested to hear what people think about this. I think it opens up the floodgates, and maybe civil prosecution, not criminal prosecution involving jail time, would be more appropriate. But tell us your thoughts. 631-451-1039. If you're interested in commenting and maybe changing our minds here.
It is, these active shooter cases are very, very difficult. Even the police, law enforcement, has changed their approach to them. It used to be that they would wait, get back up, go in, be secure. The latest being within the last few years, is they realized that the school shooters, and not just school, but active shooters, that most of the deaths, almost all the deaths, occur within the first 3 to 5 minutes. And the response time for police, backup, or whoever, is typically longer than that or right around then. So you can't wait. So the rule and the teaching now is you hear gunshots, you have to go and try to neutralize the person immediately. You can't wait. A number of episodes ago, we had Commissioner Pat Ryder from Nassau County on to talk about, right after the Texas shooting, to talk about school shootings and what his police officers are trained to do and how he works with the schools here in Nassau County. Very interesting. But you still have this instance where somebody panicked, presumably, or didn't really know what to do, didn't know where the gunshots were, and he didn't act, like you said, in the manner in which the
he was trained to act.
And expected to act. And he ended up getting prosecuted. So if somebody wants to weigh in on that, that's great. Please do. Obviously, we don't think he should be prosecuted. Now, we don't know the specific statutes, but it seems to be just kind of on principle, a stretch.
He's going to have to live with. You want, like, generally speaking, I know not all crimes involve elements of intent. You know, you can be charged with reckless crimes as well. But generally speaking, you want to penalize and criminalize intentional conduct, right?
And guilty minds, right.
Like a guilty mind, malice. Really, that's what should be prosecuted, not something like this. But here, I don't know what his training involved, but if he's never been in this situation, frankly, none of us knows how we would react.
It's true. And look, lifeguards train over and over again to get into the water. They have tools and so on and so forth. They presumably are athletic and train their bodies so they know what's going on. They know what they can do. Even in those instances, you wouldn't be expected to dive into a raging tsunami or a hurricane or something. And that's kind of what this person was confronted with. It wasn't one person having a fight. It was an individual with an assault rifle firing weapons. And he had...
But a lot of times we have sort of this hindsight problem is the peanut gallery when we watch crimes unfold and they're reported to us by the media and we have kind of a global understanding of all the details of what occurred. But when you're on the ground, you don't necessarily know what's happening, right? And so his lawyer was arguing that he didn't know where the shots were coming from specifically, or how many shooters there were, right? So if you don't see the shooter and you're not actually seeing what's going on, you might think that there's multiple shooters. I remember, and this is sort of a weird example, but September 11, 2001, I quickly learned, I was in the city and I worked in the city and I actually took the subway underneath the World Trade Center. We all know what happened that day. We all know how many planes were in the sky and how many planes crashed. But we didn't know how that day was going to end while we were living it. And so I recall leaving my job. So I went underneath the towers, up the subway, all the way uptown to about 50th and Broadway, only to really understand the extent of what had happened. I watched the second building fall, and then I had to go home and figure out a way home. But at the time, we were terrified that there were going to be more planes. So we avoided, Fifth Avenue. We avoided the Empire State Building. We avoided the UN building, buildings we deemed landmark buildings that might be attacked. And I can appreciate how someone in his shoes, I'm not saying that, he was brave or that his conduct was warranted necessarily, but you really don't know someone's perspective until you literally walk in their shoes. And to do that, you have to eliminate the knowledge you learn after the media reports and think of only the knowledge that is available to that defendant, that person who is accused at the time he is experiencing the crime, right?
No, I agree with you. I agree with you. Doesn't make for great radio, maybe. We don't have a disagreement, but I agree with you. I think this prosecution is ill-advised. I hope he gets acquitted, and we'll see what ends up happening.
We we have James from Calverton the line, and I think he might want to weigh in.
I just want to say something real quick.
Perspective out there, or agree with us. We love it when people agree with us.
James, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me? Hello?
We can't quite hear him.
I can't hear him at all.
I'm full blast, but I'm on speakerphone. Hello? You can't hear me?
So the magic of radio is... done it to us again. So we can't hear him. I'm curious as to what he had to say. I actually want to talk about, in the few minutes that we have left on the radio, kind of forever, or at least for the time being, talk a little bit more about the show that we've done. I want people to pay attention to the tagline, Crime and Justice Radio. You may hear from us again in another venue, in another setting at some point in the future. We're going to reflect upon how we can do this show well while keeping up with our day job, which is fairly hectic and fairly busy. And there are individuals out there who are being prosecuted every day, not only for crimes that we don't think they committed, but in some instances for conduct that the Supreme Court has decided isn't criminal at all. So there's an individual named Marcos D'Angelo Jones, who was convicted of two counts of unlawful possession of a firearm by a felon and making false statements to require or acquire a firearm. the Supreme Court has, since his conviction, decided that the conduct he engaged in is not a violation of that statute. So it's not a question of he didn't do it. It's a question of what he did is not a crime. Yet, 6-3, the Supreme Court of the United States said he can't get relief and has to continue to serve his sentence. His conviction can't be vacated because of technical rules about federal habeas practice that it can be summed up, I think, by one of the dissenting opinions that goes something like this from Justice, how do you say it? Your Spanish, Sotomayor? Sotomayor. how do you say it? Say it one more time.
I just made some accent up to see if you would follow my...
see if I'd follow
Sotomayor.
You?
Sotomayor.
So this is what she said. So the court holds today that an incarcerated individual has already filed one post-conviction petition, cannot file another one to assert a previously unavailable claim of statutory innocence. In other words, this decision wasn't out when he filed his first habeas petition. The majority says the result follows from a straightforward reading of the statute, but the majority reaches this decision wrongly, essentially. And it's far from obvious that the reading of the statute is correct from this. And Sotomayor sums it up as follows. A prisoner who's actually innocent, imprisoned for conduct that Congress did not criminalize, is forever barred from raising that claim merely because he previously sought post-conviction relief. It does not matter that an intervening decision of this court confirms his innocence. By challenging his conviction once before, he has forfeited his freedom.
Chris?
Yes.
We got 10 seconds left. Look
love
at you.
Love the show.
Litigating
the show.
Passion. Down to the very last second.
Love the show. Love doing it with you.
It's been a pleasure, Bruce. Good luck tomorrow.
We'll see you again. Thanks. Talk to you later. Crime and Justice Radio, BarquetteEpstein.com. Go look it up. We'll talk to you soon.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.